corporate activity in the crypto space has really picked up. You've seen a number of businesses either do acquisitions of smaller crypto firms or strategic partnerships. And we want to talk about why a company would want to do one versus the other.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto is a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. This week, we have David Shapiro and Gotham Diva, and myself, Matt Allen. And today, we're going to be talking about M&A, strategic investments in the crypto world, why companies might consider them, what they mean, and why they're important to users. We also have a couple of key news stories, the main one being the Babylon launch on mainnet Bitcoin. Gotham, do you want to kick us off with that one?
Yeah. So for those of you that don't know, Babylon is a self-custodial protocol that enables Bitcoin holders to earn yield by locking their BTC into kind of like a proof of stake system. So the protocol uses Bitcoin's inherent security as sort of a foundation. And the claim is that with the Babylon Genesis being its like first layer one blockchain secured by Bitcoin, it's extending Bitcoin's utility beyond being like a store of value. But essentially, they had just launched their Genesis mainnet, which is the second phase of Babylon's like three-stage rollout. The first stage is usually like a test net where they test out the features. And then the third stage is more for like future plans. But this is like them actually launching their mainnet. So the network would basically allow them to stake their Bitcoin. And it will also enable staking Babylon's native token referred to as like baby. So rewards on the network are distributed equally. 50% of the rewards go to Bitcoin stakers and 50% go to baby token stakers. But yeah, it's been getting a lot of attention. I think it's quite interesting that Babylon is kind of taking this significant step forward and combining Bitcoin security with the functionality of decentralized finance, right? And by enabling users to earn yield on Bitcoin holdings and supporting like, you know, the broader digital economy through integrated decentralized applications, Babylon is kind of demonstrating this move here to kind of increase Bitcoin utilization, right? But I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on this, David and Matt.
It sort of reminds me of EigenLayer. I don't know if that's a perfect parallel to draw here because it's not technically restaking. But you're ultimately taking an L1 asset and earning additional yield on it. So I know that Babylon derives its security from the Bitcoin network. But how exactly does that work, Gotham? Like, is it similar to Eigen or what?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So it's kind of like they... you know, you kind of lock in BTC and then there's like fees involved specifically. And then at some point, like it's kind of similar to staking.
So Babylon calls what I would refer to as their validators, finality providers. So you stake your Bitcoin to a finality provider and they are the ones providing the security to the Babylon Genesis chain. But David, to your point, I do think that there are similarities to EigenLayer here in that it's not restaking in that you're like staking another staked asset, but it might be considered restaking in the form that you're reusing security. So you're reusing the Bitcoin proof of work security to then secure another chain. So I think that that's a really great parallel to draw. I also think another interesting aspect of Babylon is just how much TVL they've attracted. It's over $4 billion in Bitcoin locked on the Babylon staking protocol. And Babylon was introduced, I think it was introduced last year. It's been around for quite a while, but they just launched this their layer one, which is their Genesis chain, which will actually start to enable like one, the chain to function, but also two, users of both Baby and Bitcoin to earn staking rewards. So there's been a lot of Bitcoin locked up on this chain for a long time. not earning any rewards. And now we actually get to see the fruits of that labor, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah. And we're also getting to see a lot of like integrations and partnerships as well. Like we're seeing a lot of the several crypto firms like BitGo and Anchorage like try to basically, like they reported to plan integrating Babylon into as a Bitcoin staking solution. So there's definitely a lot of attraction to that. But yeah, 57,000 BTC into the lock, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's quite a lot. And another interesting aspect of this story too is that while they launched the Genesis chain this week, the next sort of phase in the roadmap is securing other networks with this BTC staking and Finality provider setup. So we might see other projects launch what they're calling Bitcoin secured networks. It could be a whole host of chains. And I think watching that ecosystem develop will be very interesting.
It's really interesting. You're seeing Bitcoin sort of interact with parallel networks like Babylon, but also the expansion and proliferation of Bitcoin L2s happening at the same time. And if you remember, a long, long time ago, there was a theory that all activity would eventually come back to Bitcoin, but the Bitcoin community was somewhat hostile to these types of ideas. And so then a big theory became that, well, all this activity will go to other L1s like Ethereum and Solana. But now it appears that Bitcoin is sort of taking a shot at attracting all of this activity back onto its network, whether it's through L2s or through these sort of parallel networks like Babylon. So it's very fascinating.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think 5 years ago, if you told me that we'd be talking about Bitcoin staking, Bitcoin rollups, and Bitcoin DeFi, I would not have believed you. But here we are. Should we get into our main theme then, which is really crypto M&A, acquisitions, and strategic investments?
Yeah, definitely.
David, do you want to give a high-level overview of kind of how one might think about the process of thinking to acquire a company or make a strategic partnership or investment?
Yeah. So, in the past few months, especially this year, as corporate activity in the crypto space has really picked up, you've seen a number of businesses either do acquisitions of smaller crypto firms or strategic partnerships. And we kind of want to talk about why a company would want to do one versus the other. So an acquisition is ultimately a riskier move, right? The company is acquiring a target company, and these comes with like very high upfront costs. But in return, you get control over the company. And a lot of times this will be done to maybe eliminate competition, or to achieve economies of scale, or to gain a significant market share quickly. A lot of times one of these startups might have a customer base that the acquiring company wants. And other times it may have to do with employee and talent. A lot of these bigger traditional finance companies have a lot of trouble recruiting engineers and crypto talent. And sometimes the target company may have employee talent that is seen as very lucrative. On the other side of the coin, you have strategic partnerships. So a strategic partnership is maybe more of a way for you to dip your toes in the water. It can be like a stepping stone to an eventual full acquisition. But usually what happens is the company will offer capital and then sometimes strategic or operational advice. And usually they'll try to form a partnership that benefits both parties. However, the company putting up the capital does not get access to talent. They don't get much control over the target company. But it's a good way to sort of explore synergies, get strategic insight, and enter a new market without a huge capital outlay. So that's sort of the trade-offs between the two. I think we'll talk now about, some specific examples of these that have happened recently.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think before we touch on specific examples, I just want to add one piece, which is if you start to think about why a company might pay a premium, which you always will have to pay in an acquisition scenario to acquire another company, It typically has to do with what you just said, David, which is synergies. And the idea of a synergy is that if I have 1 + 1, it doesn't equal 2 anymore. It actually equals 3, right? So the two companies together are more profitable, more efficient, you know, better overall for the market or for themselves than if they were separate. Synergies are incredibly hard to realize historically. That's why you have, you know, like integration consultants and that kind of thing. But that's another really big rationale for actually going out and acquiring. So I think a good example of that is actually the NinjaTrader and Kraken acquisition, which we talked about a few weeks ago. So in that scenario, Kraken pays $1.5 billion for NinjaTrader, which I think at first glance might seem like quite a lot of money for the amount of users that NinjaTrader had on their platform. But from Kraken's perspective, they really wanted those users. They saw them as more valuable to their overall platform than just trying to expand organically. Because those users were trading more traditional assets. And then additionally, from NinjaTrader's perspective, Kraken has licenses in the EU and in Australia. And so they were going to be able to expand their overall presence. So that's kind of like a good example of a potential synergy. I don't know if either of you have any additional thoughts on some of the recent activity.
I think some of it may have to do with acquiring a license. We spoke about this a little bit before, but a lot of times the target company may hold some type of regulatory license that the company putting up the capital is interested in. And it might be cheaper to go out and buy the company with the license than to go get it yourself. So I think that's a big factor here.
Yeah, additional reasons for typically why you'd get an acquisition would be a valuable customer base, accessing like a larger customer base, you know, acquiring you want to tap into, or maybe acquiring talent per se. So rapidly involving, you know, technical talent at the target company and major incentives could be a big factor there too.
I'd also say speed to market is another big one. I think if Kraken feels like they need to get out there quickly with a derivatives product, an acquisition might be the way to go, you know, if speed is their top priority.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a huge benefit of just going out and acquiring, right? Like, this product already exists. You, of course, have to pay a premium upfront for it, and you have to deal with the integration risks that come on down the line, but you now have this product. You go from day zero not having it to day one having it. I mean, that's a big, big advantage.
Yeah. I think integration is the big trade-off here is, if you buy, you have to integrate it into your own systems rather than building it from scratch on your own platform. Like you said, Matt, you can sort of eliminate the integration risk if you go that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think even beyond technically, there's also the cultural integration, right? Every company has their own culture. And if all of a sudden you're absorbed into a much larger company with a different culture, it might be more incentive for key talent to leave. You know, I think that's always a risk.
Yeah.
Definitely. But yeah, as you both have said, you know, I think it also absorbing another business can lead to like cost efficiencies, right? So like you're consolidating operations and kind of expanding market share. I guess there's also an argument to be made that you're kind of eliminating competition as well. So if you're acquiring companies, like if you're buying from a competitor, you're kind of strengthening your market position as well.
Yeah, like I think that was the main rationale between Facebook buying Instagram was like competition concerns. And another, you know, high profile one of these was Stripe acquiring a stablecoin firm. And I think the fact that they acquired it and didn't just dip their toes into the water, like with a strategic partnership, sent a very strong message to the market.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think some of the big takeaways from these big acquisitions that we're seeing are just that large companies like Stripe and Kraken are very serious about expanding their product offering. And I think from like a user's perspective, that's a big positive. You know, it's a lot easier if everything that you want to do, both even, you know, crypto, non-crypto, is all on one platform than if it's across disparate platforms and you have to go to use different apps and, you know, track different accounts. I think that from a user's perspective, is really positive.
Definitely.
Should we move on and talk about some strategic partnerships?
Yeah, definitely.
I think to lead in, there is one that we wrote about today, which is Apollo's investment into Plume, which I personally think is very interesting. So Apollo, for those who aren't aware, is one of the largest alternative asset managers in the world. They have over $750 billion in assets under management. They have been making recent moves to move into the tokenization, more of the crypto sphere. So about a month ago, actually the end of January, so longer than a month, time flies in crypto. They partnered with Securitize to tokenize one of their credit funds, ACRED. This was seen as a very big deal at the time, moving this asset on chain, very exciting news. And now just a couple of months later, they've announced a strategic partnership and investment into Plume, which is a real-world asset tokenization platform. Now, Plume is not on mainnet yet. However, it does seem that a mainnet launch is imminent. They have over 18 million users. But I think it's just a really interesting case study in how you think about who you're working with, what your partnerships are, and why Apollo might find value in this relatively early investment in Plume.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Apollo has some products that are available to retail. I think most of their products are for accredited investors. And when you look at what's going on in tokenization right now, there's like one school of thought that says if we take these like less liquid assets and move them on chain, maybe that will bring a lot more people in. And then the other side of the coin is, well, if you look at what tokenized products have seen the most uptake, it's the traditional finance assets that are the most liquid and most widely available. So like treasuries and cash, basically, right? Those are the products on chain that we've seen explosive popularity in. And so, you know, these firms that might be trying to take these less liquid, harder to access assets, with the theory that putting them on chain will improve accessibility to them, is, I think, the jury's still out on that idea. And plays like this Apollo one, depending on what they end up tokenizing and putting on chain, I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I mean, I think a narrative that has long been held in crypto and tokenization spheres is that eventually we'll be able to tokenize private assets and bring liquidity to private markets. I think to date, what we've seen is that is very challenging from like an operational perspective and also a regulatory perspective. So I think like Apollo moving into this space, like, is it still early? Of course, but I do think it's also really interesting as you consider some of the like products that they may be able to bring on chain, you know, they might be able to realize that vision of like bringing some really illiquid assets on chain.
Yeah, I feel like if they're able to pull this off, you know, I feel like they're, you know, could redefine how assets are managed and traded, right? I feel like we've seen in the news quite a lot of these, like, you know, the tokenization of efforts of just like, you know, trying to bridge between the two worlds, right? Between DeFi and TriFi, right? But it is that, like, it is a complexity, right? As you said, Matt, with like the regulatory hurdles and, you know, trying to, you know, kind of navigate that jurisdiction.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's probably also why they found Plume so attractive. Like part of the issue here is that the vast majority of Apollo's products are only available to accredited investors. And if you were just going to go and like put a private equity fund, tokenize it and put it on ETH, like a stable coin, well, I mean, that's like hugely regulatory, not compliant. So you have to work with some sort of provider that like balances the like permissionless aspect of blockchains with the regulatory requirement that only accredited investors can invest in a lot of these products that Apollo is trying to tokenize. It appears like the technology at Plume will allow them to KYC, you know, abide by KYC, AML, investor requirements, such as making sure that their investors are accredited. We'll still definitely have to see. It's still on testnet. But I think it's an interesting partnership, especially as you consider like BlackRock and Securitize. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit as well.
One thing is, like, you know, there's been murmurs of possibly changing the rules around accredited investors and switching it to being a test, which could possibly bring far more quote unquote accredited investors into the market. And that may be part of what Apollo is looking at when they start thinking about moving these private assets on chain. It's like, if we get a rule change there and then it becomes a test to become an accredited investor, then their TAM grows by a lot. So I suspect that could be a factor here.
Yeah, I think not only that, but even in the regulatory landscape that we have today, like, there is still an access issue, even if you are accredited to some of these products. I mean, you go from one day being not accredited to being accredited the next day, and all of a sudden you have a whole entire new world of investment products available to you. And if you're not working with an advisor who is like choosing these products for you, it can be quite overwhelming. And then like, how do you actually access them can be a whole nother hurdle. I think that by bringing tokenizing some of these products and bringing them on chain, it would really lower that aspect specifically, even with no other, you know, regulatory changes. But I think another aspect, just to kind of look at this story from, or another angle to consider this story from, is the BlackRock and Securitize partnership. So that's another strategic partnership that we've seen in the market. And interestingly, Apollo tokenized their diversified credit fund with Securitize. And now they're moving in a different direction with a strategic investment into Plume, which appears to be, in some senses, a competitor to Securitize. Do you guys have any thoughts on what that might mean, or if there's even any significance there?
It's hard to know. You know, there's not a whole lot of transparency into these types of things, but who knows what kinds of protective provisions BlackRock negotiated with Securitize. They could have things like rights of first refusals, or you can negotiate board seats, veto rights. There's all kinds of things. So I don't think we have a whole lot of transparency into what BlackRock's agreement with Securitize is like. That could be a factor. It's also possible that Apollo is just sort of diversifying their plays, right? You know, they want to have a stake or a relationship in all of the big tokenization platforms.
Yep, I was actually thinking about that as well, David. You know, Apollo could be positioning themselves to explore multiple, you know, technological approaches, right, with the on-chain asset tokenization. So while there's one model with securitizing things, Plume might offer different capabilities for better scalability for different assets, right? But yeah, as you mentioned, only time will tell, right?
Yeah, I think that's the big takeaway here. We only have a few minutes left, but I think that another interesting case study we can get into is Coinbase and Base. David, do you want to take that one away?
Sure. So this goes back to our build versus buy theme on this episode. And Base is a really great case study here, because Coinbase built the Base platform in-house. Base is an Ethereum L2. And they built this platform in-house, but then they've leveraged their venture fund, Coinbase Ventures, to invest in a number of startups building infrastructure on Base. And then they also have, outside of their venture firm, a number of grant programs to sort of foster community growth on Base. So there are builder grants where they offer small grants of, say, like 1 to 5 ETH to independent builders building on Base. They also have their Coinbase developer platform grants. So if you leverage some of the products on their developer platform, think AWS, but for crypto applications, if you leverage those, they have a bunch of grants available for you. And then finally, which I think is the most interesting one, is their gas credits program. So if you're building an application on Base, they will give you like up to $15,000 worth of gas credits so that your application's users don't have to pay transaction fees. And so we've seen this with products like USDC on Base, where you can transfer without any transaction fees. And this has huge UX implications, positive ones, where users don't necessarily have to fund their wallets before they interact with the Base network, and you don't have to deal with the US hacks hassle of transaction fees. So to summarize all of this, it's sort of a combination of building in-house and then acquiring stakes in companies through their venture arm, as well as all these grant programs. It sort of combines all the themes that we've talked about today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great example, right? Like, you're building and then also bootstrapping the ecosystem around what you've built. And so you kind of creating a flywheel effect where each incremental increase on either base or in the companies that Coinbase is investing in, like, helps the other one. So I think it's a really, really interesting case study.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, a lot with these initiatives, right? Especially with the, you know, combining these developer incentives, right? It combines a more robust and attractive platform that not only drives adoption, but also improves the overall, like, user experience. Like, it's a really, it's definitely like an attractive way to, like, get people into digital assets as well. Just make it easier.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think maybe that's one of the biggest takeaways from this episode is that while we're seeing more investment into the crypto space, whether it's through strategic partnerships, through M&A, through this base ecosystem, which kind of combines all of the above, like, the end goal and, like, hopefully the end result is driving a better user experience and user interface. Any other key takeaways?
If you look at the data and the usage on base, you know, it appears that their strategy is working out pretty well for them. You know, I think there's really strong data about base usage and its growth, maybe over the past 6 to 8 months, that I think validate their strategy.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the base ecosystem is very successful, and I would imagine will continue to be. Well, I think that's all that we have for everyone today. Thank you for everyone for joining. We look forward to seeing you again next episode, which, as a reminder, will be in 2 weeks. And make sure to tune in as we plan to cover ETH's next upgrade.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution would or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.